My name is Chris Kennedy, and I'm the president of Merchandise Mart Properties, which is headquartered here in Chicago. I'm also a volunteer for the University of Illinois, and for the last 15 months, I've served as chairman of the board. It is in that capacity as chairman that I want to extend a welcome to all of you to our campus here, the University of Illinois at Chicago. This campus educates about 27,000 students per year, and we have total research expenditures of about $250 million a year, which, with the exception of our flagship Urbana campus, is more research funding than occurs at all of the other public universities in Illinois combined. We train nearly 20% of Illinois' physicians, over 40% of its dentists, a third of its pharmacists, and we are the largest educator of its nurses. This entire campus was the vision of Mayor Richard J. Daley. There is a great quote from President Kennedy: "Every man can make a difference, and every man should try." This extraordinary campus is a living embodiment of the notion that the visions being developed by people assembled at this conference can fundamentally change our cities the way Mayor Daley did. As long as I'm quoting great leaders, I might suggest, as you think about the speakers whom you hear during the Global Metro Summit, it is great to keep in mind one of Mayor Daley's favorite quotes, which was, "Go big or go home." The future of cities in our metro areas are critical to the world economy. I see that in my own business here in Chicago. 20 years ago, our competitors in the real estate business were located across Kinzie Street or down the LaSalle Street corridor or located somewhere along Wacker Drive. Our trade shows competed with events held in Dallas, in Atlanta, and Las Vegas. After 20 years of consolidation, our major competitors in the real estate business are enormous REITs headquartered in Boston and New York, funds managed out of Montreal, Toronto, or California, and powerful real estate ventures headquartered across the globe in places like Australia or New Zealand. Over 2,000 showroom tenants and 10,000 companies that exhibit in our trade shows are not impacted just by local regulations, but more importantly, by global negotiations. If a bridal gown manufacturer based in New York has reached the global limits for finished good imports from China, then they no longer want to participate in our trade shows here in Chicago. When the recession occurred and the price of nylon dropped, an American-based conglomerate shut down much of their European nylon extrusion business, and this impacted us because an Atlanta-based carpet manufacturer with factories on four continents could no longer easily manufacture carpet tiles and had to curb their economic activity in the United States, in Canada, and in a dozen other countries in which they operate. This diminished their interest in a showroom at the Merchandise Mart and their desire to participate in trade shows we run in Canada and throughout North America. More generally, it impacted the city of Chicago because the same company was less intent on occupying retail space along the Clybourne Avenue corridor and thought twice about expanding their back office operations in the South Loop. For many of our companies, what happens in Madrid is just as important as what happens in Chicago. What happens in Sao Paulo is as critical to their success and to their future as what happens in Naperville. Our major companies like Abbott, Baxter, Motorola, Caterpillar, and Illinois Tool Works are as greatly affected by the global economy as they are by government regulations in their suburban hometowns of Lake Forest, Deerfield, Schaumburg, Peoria, or Glenview. We are lucky to have all of you here today thinking about these issues on our behalf and protecting our local economy by advocating for the success of global cities. At this time, I'd like to bring up our speakers for this afternoon's first discussion, a conversation on emerging markets and global urbanization. Joan Close is the former Spanish ambassador to the Republic of Turkey and Azerbaijan and the current UN Undersecretary General and Executive Director of UN Habitat. Jose Serra is the former governor of the state of Sao Paulo and the former mayor of the city of Sao Paulo. We have two moderators for this afternoon's discussion. The first moderator is Ricky Burdett, the professor of urban studies and the director of the LSC Cities Program at the London School of Economics. Among many other things, Ricky was the chairman of the jury for the 2007 Mies van der Rohe Prize. Therefore, we're especially pleased to have him here in Chicago. If any of you traveled through O'Hare, you probably saw the work of the great Chicago architect Helmut Jahn, who tutored under Mies. and shares the role of a disciple of Mies along with dozens of world-class Chicago-based architects. It's great to have Ricky, the great champion of Mies' work here in our city, which Mies and his followers fundamentally changed. Also moderating the speaker discussion will be Bruce Katz, the vice president at the Brookings Institution and director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program. Bruce knows how to get the most out of speakers because he himself has given dozens of lectures and presentations each year. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ambassador Close, Governor Sarah, Bruce Katz, and Ricky Burdett.
So folks, I hope people feel that that was a productive morning. I mean, I think when I try to reflect on the central takeaways, metros as the driving engines of their national economies, which then logically leads to metros acting with intentionality and purpose. And in a world of metros, the possibility to learn from each other and to learn what has worked, as we did in Barcelona and Munich and Turin, and how that informs real live action in American metros is very, very real. But we've got to expand out to a bigger globe, because as our work with LSE showed literally a week ago, the shift of economic power in the world is shifting not just among nations, but among metropolitan areas. So we felt today, for this session, we could sit with two individuals who Ricky will introduce because he knows them intimately, and have a conversation from their deep experience, both about cross-metro learning, given what they've accomplished in their public life, but also about how their views of emerging market metros can inform American metro practice.
Thank you, Bruce. And I'm delighted to hear you feel the way you do about this morning, and I'm sure you will when this session ends. I don't think we could have in the room two individuals who have, in their personal lives, effectively enacted vertical alignment. I mean, you've gone from, I'm sure, community leaders to mayors to governors to ambassadors to secretary of states and nearly to president in the case of Sarah. I just want to say a couple of things about their backgrounds to frame then the discussion that we're going to have. Perhaps it's not by chance that we actually have an economist, a distinguished economist in the shape of Governor Serra, who became the Minister of Health at the Brazilian national level. And we have a doctor who became the Secretary of State for Industry and Energy and Trade and Tourism and a few other things in the Spanish government. This says something about personal engagement with society and the desire to change things. But both of their levels of engagement have absolutely come from the belief in the city and in the metropolis. Both of them, in the case of Sarah, were instrumental in moving from being the mayor of São Paulo, already a massive city of economic engine, of course, of Brazil, to then dealing with a lot of the issues that couldn't be dealt with at city level, to being the governor of one of the largest populated regions in South America, which is the state of São Paulo. I'm sure he'll talk about that. We were just having a conversation, and he reminded me, yes, unfortunately, he lost the election to become the president of Brazil. He did get 45 million votes in this
45.
Election.
45 million.
45 million votes. So, you know, that puts things into context. But certainly in the last Urban Age conferences that we've had where he's been able to attend, he's always brought a sort of intelligence on how policy and different forms of governance are fundamental in shaping decisions at the metro level. In the case of Dr. Close, our history in a way goes back to when we started discussions, much smaller scale than these, with the London School of Economics, which is how we then met up with the Alfred Herrhausen Society and Wolfgang Novak, which was a number of mayors just talking to each other, and most importantly, about their problems. What doesn't work, and what can we get right? And it was interesting to see that that's where we are now. Over the years, with the Urban Age family, with the LSE, we've kept very close contact and always discuss issues of density, of social cohesion, planning, and jobs in an integrated way. And the fact that he secretly got the job, he didn't tell any of us, we had to read it in the newspapers, running UN Habitat, I think is of enormous significance, because that's where the problem is going to be, as we've heard before, in terms of urban growth. That's where the greatest concentrations of problems are, not just in South Chicago or in Liverpool, but in Lagos, in parts of South America, and in other Asian cities. So I really feel we have today two people who can cut across many of the disciplines we've discussed. So let's start.
So let me start with a question about global urbanization. So last week, LSE and Brookings put out a report that assessed the economic performance of the top 150 metropolitan areas in the world, 50 in the United States, 50 in Europe, 50 in Asia and Latin America, primarily. And what we found, not surprising, is that the top performers coming out of this recession are all in Asia and Latin America, and the bottom performers are all in Europe and the United States, when you look at unemployment change and income change. What this is basically revealing is a tectonic shift in the locus of economic power in the globe to new emerging markets, but even more precisely emerging market metros. It's happening at a pace and a scale and a complexity, which is really quite remarkable. So Sao Paulo is the 25th highest performer of these 150 in the past year. Istanbul, where you were just ambassador, was the number one performer in the past year. What's happening here? I mean, Americans look at this, and obviously we think about some of the challenges that are affecting these mega cities and rapidly growing cities, primarily in Asia and Latin America. We also think about market opportunities. But from your own vantage point, from the ground up, what is happening?
First. Well, let me tell first that for me it's a privilege to be part of the Urban Age. Since the last summit in Berlin, 2006, when I was just elected for São Paulo's government. And after these intense presidential elections in Brazil, Urban Age is for me an excellent opportunity to reconnect with friends and to get new ideas about public policies. Well, really, the impact of the international crisis was milder in Brazil, since the city and the metro region of São Paulo represent about 20% of our national GDP. Let's say the macro impact of the international crisis was not so sharp as in developed countries in the northern hemisphere. This is one point. Second, we must take in account that we didn't have in Brazil both financial crises in the domestic financial sector, which was very protected because of some reforms that had been carried out in the 90s. And second, also the foreign trade is not so important in Brazil in relative terms, as a fraction of the GDP. So the impact was lower. And also, at that time, we had a peak. We lived the peak of public investments, both from the state and from the city of São Paulo. We had the highest investment level of our history because we had plans before, we had financing, and also an increasing in tax revenues. We multiplied by three the public investments of the state, by two the investments of the city. So this was an important contribution to get employment high, let's say. I would mention these three factors.
Interesting.
Yes. I think that if we look at the global scenario, we should differentiate different situations of these cities that you have presented in the report, which is, by the way, very interesting, and I congratulate you because it provides new insights on this always very attractive issue of cities. But the ones that now are driving and are increasing and are powerful and are, you know, they look with extraordinary figures, they have, most of them, something in common. They are becoming industrial cities. They were not, and now they are becoming industrial cities. And this is the case of most of China, this is the case of part of India, this is the case of part of South America, and this is the case of Istanbul, that you rank it as number one. It's important also to realize that the GDP per capita in these cities is in the range between, let's say, $5,000 to $12,000 per capita. It remembers of the growth of our industrial cities 30 or 40 years ago. It seems that it's a kind of, you know, something that happens, but not at the same time. But it's more or less a very similar model. If you look at the evolution of Pittsburgh or Detroit or whatever city in America after the Second World War, you would be that in terms of GDP per capita and in terms of growth, it's quite similar, with the corrections that you can introduce, to what is happening now in these big industrializing countries which are growing very fast, that you ranked the best ones. The variables that you choose to rank the performance, of course, makes the classification. If you would rank the cities by GDP per capita, that would be a totally different map. The interesting thing, though, is that this is only one of the three categories of cities. Then we have the European and the American cities that we are striving to keep at the same level of population. And in most of the European cities and the American cities lose population. But this is not a kind of, you know, failure, because the population sometimes spread over the land and makes this awful thing of the sprawl. But this is because they have money. You know, you can only sprawl if you are rich. If you are poor, you cannot sprawl. Okay, then, and this is, you know, to put the level to that as a failure, well, it depends. If I would prefer to see an unemployment or an equality in the cities, if it improves or go the other way around. And then we have a totally different evolution of cities, which is mainly in Africa but also in Asia, which they are growing very fast, but in a pre-industrial model. They don't have industry, but they see thousands of people arriving to the city every day, and they don't know why. You know, because one can understand why the people go to an industrial city, because if you go there to find a job. But if there's no real economical engine in a pre-industrial city, like most of these megalopolis, why people is going to those megalopolis, one can ask. And the answer, curiously, is that they are not going by will to the city. They are pushed out of the fields because of the agrarian reforms of those countries. It's a very different situation. Then you have three kinds of cities. The developed world cities, where we have the kind of problems that we have been looking around, trying to keep jobs, trying to improve things, trying to avoid the new risk of the divide inside the city, which is very important. Then we have a second group of cities, Sao Paulo, Istanbul, and most of the Chinese cities, where the main factor of growth now is industrialization, like us in the future. And then we have the most difficult and unknown precedent of cities which grow without an industrial model. And that comes as back to the commercial revolution in the 12th century, or even the big cities of 600 or 1,000 years ago. And in those places is where the most difficult things happen.
If one takes what you just said and just thinks of the sheer scale and the pace of change, particularly in this second and third category of city that you were describing, I mean, some of us have done research in this area and found out that for practically every minute that I speak now, we speak, a new person is either born or moves to Lagos, Kinshasa, Nairobi, and Indian cities, right? So there's an issue of not just numbers, but the pace of change, and therefore how do you provide the infrastructure and for this pace of change? In other words, you're dealing with cities which go from 5 million to 6 million in years, not in decades, so that's an issue. But the second point that it would be good to hear both of you reflect on is the issue raised by others this morning in a panel, which was very rightly American-centric, which is the one of inequality. Right? If I'm right, but you're now UN Habitat, so you have the statistics, 33% of all urban dwellers today, urban meaning anything above a village of 20,000, let's call it, live in slums. 30%. So we're talking about a large amount of humankind living in conditions without water, sanitation, or basic services. And these are the numbers that are growing, right? These are exactly the sort of, as you say, we don't know why people come to them. How does one deal with this? How does one deal with this problem of growth, pace, and inequality?
Yeah. In the case of São Paulo, the growth of population was in the past. We increased by 5 times in 50 years. But now, the expansion is decelerated.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of inequalities. You mentioned the question of slums. Our policy was not to build, according to Brazilian bad tradition, housing in the periphery of the cities, far from social services, you know, far from the jobs, isolated. We have, this is a drama there. And in São Paulo we did change, but not in the whole country. This keeps being a kind of pattern, you know, to isolate people, not deliberately, but they just built housing. You know, this, the private sector loved this, you know. Lost because it's easy, no? You build for 200, 300,000 people, and they get isolated. But we prefer to transform, say, to change slums in neighborhoods. As we say there, favela em bairro. The favelas, Brazilian favelas, in bairros. Investing is very expensive, but there is no way. Investing in sanitation, investing in water, sewage, schools, healthcare, illuminating. So they are becoming really neighborhoods. The two main São Paulo favelas, now you can say, well, there are more bairros, more neighborhoods than favelas. And this, of course, improves the condition of living of the people there, and it's important to say, they live close to their jobs, where they work. Yeah. So this is the best for them. Yeah. Okay. This is a very, I'd say, is an expensive, it's very expensive. It's more expensive than to build new housing.
But this is a very interesting good news, in the sense that you are a city that which is industrializing very fast.
Yeah. It's not industrializing very fast anymore.
No, in the periphery of
in the metropolitan, not in the core of the city.
No, in the core of the city, no. But in the periphery, you have a lot of industry, and then you have a force that is driving the dynamics of the urbanization pattern. But and this industrialization, in a way, is seen something like good, you know, because it provides and a scheme of social driving force for urbanization. The big problem of cities is in the other the other category of city, when we are in a pre-industrial scenario, where there's no industry, it's a little bit of trade, commerce, perhaps some tourism, but really, the institutions of these poor countries cannot host foreign investment, they cannot guarantee legal security, and then there's no investment. And what is happening on the slums of these other kind of cities is that people is arriving there, it's putting all together, and they, in fact, they are worse off than they were in the field, okay? Then for the first time in history, we see that people go to the city not to be better off.
Just to get worse.
Just to get worse. And this is something new, something... and when we talk with the governments, we found that they clearly have an agriculture policy, because those countries which are not yet industrial, they know that, and they are willing, and they work in order to be agriculturally self-sufficient. And they do an agricultural policy, but they don't still link the agriculture policy with the movement of population. And this is something that it's lacking then. And then we have this huge problem of the assignation of people nearby the cities, with problems of security, bands, illegal trade, exploitation, whatever. Like the 17th century in London, the Dickensian, you know, the beginning of the industrialization. This is the most similar thing. Though I am very interested of looking at the evolution of cities in this eucronial situation. Although we live all together in the 2010, there are cities which are living the economical situation of 30 years ago, like, and others of 200 years ago or 300 years ago. The difficult thing is to remember what the cities did in the past to deal with the problems. No, we cannot look at the situations of the city if the circumstances are equal for everybody today. This is not the case. And the interesting thing also is that the post-industrial city has a problem also too, a very serious problem. And this serious problem is the urban divide. The post-industrial economy, you said that this morning, creates some very interesting jobs, and then the rest, they are not very well paid. And in fact, also for the first time in history, you have neighborhoods in the post-industrial city that if you don't have welfare policies, they are getting worse off instead of improving. They see that their personal and familiar situation is decaying. And this increases the inequalities in the most rich cities in the world. And careful with that, because out of here can come, of course, social and political consequences. And it's very interesting to see that every kind of the three models of city has their own problems, and they need to find out their own solutions.
So I just got a note that we're supposed to end this panel because we're under very tight time constraints.
Then we will.
Let me conclude it in this regard, because I do think if urbanization is really the central defining theme of this century, what I think we're talking about here is what we've raised here is both the ability to share knowledge across very different kinds of cities.
Of course.
Right? So when you take your three tiers, we could see the first and second tier really beginning to learn from each other in some very intricate ways around governance, around infrastructure, around strategic planning. I think the second thing you've raised, which we can do this in another city, Ricky, in a year, national government, supranational governments, they don't seem to have realized that urbanization is the driving theme. And so another conversation about World Bank, perhaps the UN, perhaps national governments, both in the developed and developing world, how do we fundamentally align this central driving force of our century with national policy and politics?
Yeah.
With that, we have been told to leave the stage.
Very short. Well, okay.